Hello, I'm Dominic Green, Life and Arts Editor at Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to The Green Room. 30 years ago, the riots and murders that followed the publication of Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses showed that Europe had entered a new era of Islam, immigration, and identity politics. Looking back, and looking forward with me today, is Daniel Pipes, President of the Middle East Forum. Daniel Pipes, welcome to The Green Room on Spectator USA.
Thank you.
So you're a regular visitor to Europe, and what trends do you see in European politics today?
Well, I'm focused on the immigration and Islamization issues, not, for example, on the EU or economics. But I think that's justifiable in that the immigration and Islamization issues are ultimately the most important and the most driving of European attitudes. And I see a Europe that is waking slowly, reluctantly, wanting to stay in denial, but nonetheless waking to the dangers of these two processes of immigration and Islamization.
Do you see Europe as breaking down by regions in terms of its response to mass immigration, especially since the big year of 2015?
I do. I see that the Cold War division of NATO and Warsaw Pact is reemerging. And this time, it's the Central European part, the ex-Warsaw Pact, that has it right, and the NATO part that has it wrong.
What is motivating, say, the Visegrad group, for instance, of Eastern European states, what is motivating these states to take a different attitude towards immigration and towards Islam in particular than, say, states in Western Europe or Northern Europe?
I think it's partly coming out from the Soviet era and regaining a sense of the nation. And partly it is looking at what's happened in places like Germany and Sweden and saying, we don't want that.
When you look, say, even between, say, Western European capitals like, say, London and Paris, would you see different outcomes within the Western European states as well? Say, if you were to compare London and Paris or Madrid and Stockholm.
Very much so, yeah. The national differences across Europe are impressive. I like to note that there are 50 American states, and if you take away Liechtenstein and San Marino and Andorra and Vatican, and not count Turkey, you have 39 European countries. So roughly comparable in number, except obviously the European countries differ more one from the other than, say, North Dakota and South Dakota. And the trends are complex and variable. Not all of Europe faces these issues of immigration and Islamization, but most of it does. Everybody's aware of it. And I would suggest to you that there is a trend line, as I mentioned before, of increasing awareness. I note that there are 5 countries already, Poland, Czechia, Hungary, Austria, and Italy, that have in their governments elements that are focused on these topics, what I call civilizationalists, people who are determined to sustain Western civilization, otherwise known as populists or far right or nationalists. So they're already in five. In fact, they're in more.
You could add Denmark, perhaps.
Denmark,
that, yes.
And Switzerland and Norway. They're also in there. So 8 in all. But in those other 3, they're really not that active.
The term civilizationists, is this one you have coined to describe this group?
My neologism, yes.
You should copyright it, because I think it's going to be increasingly popular. What are the values around which are held in common, should we say, between the parties in these very different countries with different historical backgrounds, different social compacts, and so on? What would you see as the common factors that they have?
They want to sustain Western civilization in the larger sense. In a more practical level, it means keeping things roughly as they used to be, or going back to how they used to be, not making it less like it used to be, not wanting to have to go through fundamental changes due to immigration and, in particular, Islamization.
Do all of these parties have skeletons in the closet. I mean, most European countries, societies do have historical skeletons within living memory, most of them. Do all of these parties have a sort of a vaguely fascist association or origins? Because that is the problem, isn't it, with admitting them into the polite company of parliamentary coalitions and so on within Europe, in each country, that's been an issue.
The older ones definitely do. The oldest of all is the Freedom Party in Austria, which was founded by an ex-SS officer. The National Rally was founded by Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was neo-fascist, and so on. The newer ones, not so. The Forum for Democracy in the Netherlands, Vox in Spain, are clean. But more broadly, these parties suffer from being amateurish, having internecine squabbles, having rogue elements who say stupid things, having a whole range of internal problems. I acknowledge that. And the ones that have gotten to power, as in Poland and Hungary, do too much, take too much control of the judiciary, the media, the banks, the educational system. I acknowledge all these problems. But I'd also note that, as you suggested yourself, other parties in Europe also have skeletons. My favorite example is in Sweden, where the prime minister, back in 2016, called the Sweden Democrats a Nazi party. Not a fascist, not a neo-fascist, but a Nazi party. Now, that struck me as remarkable because he is the head of the Social Democrats. Social Democrats in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s actually worked with real Nazis, collaborated, sent them ball bearings, sent them gold, made it possible for them to cross Sweden and get between Norway and Finland and the like. And he has the nerve, the audacity to call a party which didn't exist until the 1980s Nazi. There's no penitence on the part of the Social Democrats in Sweden. They just bluster on as though this never happened. And they call others names. No. They're skeletons. And yeah, the civilizationalist parties have all sorts of problems. But, you know, François Mitterrand was working as a collaborator with the Vichy regime. Let's not get caught up in the skeletons. Let's look at what the policies are and where they stand today.
This is a key question, isn't it? Because it's something to do with historical memory and how much the past is allowed to shape the parameters of the current debate. As the Second World War era passes out of living memory, do you believe that anybody should necessarily be excluded from politics on the basis of what their predecessors or the founders or the party leadership should be able to do? I mean, personally, we all say that, you know, we shouldn't hold the children responsible for what their parents have done, but the Le Pen family is a political dynasty, and Marine Le Pen is in large part the inheritor of a party that Jean-Marie Le Pen built up. How much does this have to count in your estimation?
Well, it's a striking feature there, too, that Marine Le Pen, I believe it was in 2016, threw her father out of the party because of his persistent anti-Semitism. Now, if that doesn't justify looking at her on her own merits, I don't know what does. She's not responsible for his sins. She should be judged on what she does on her own.
This is certainly, from a rational point of view, and even an ethical one, is inarguable. But the perceptions that many people in France have, of course, is that anybody but Le Pen, whatever the first name is, anyone but a Le Pen, and this has produced, in fact, the successful election of Emmanuel Macron, who was the last man standing when it came to anyone but Le Pen. Some countries, however, as you identify in Eastern Europe, don't seem to suffer from this difficulty, in a sense. They have a different historical attitude to it. On the other hand, someone like Viktor Orban, would you call him a positive force for democracy? I mean, he is in the sense that he seems to represent what a lot of Hungarians would like to have. But in terms of the general functioning of democracy at the national level in Europe, would you see Orban as a positive figure?
I already criticized him for having too much control over the media, the banks, the judiciary, the educational system. These are problems. But aren't there also comparable problems in other countries? Haven't other governments gone too far and imposed their will too much?
I would agree with that. Yeah, I would say that the European Union, which wasn't directly elected to make these kind of decisions, has very much abrogated control over all kinds of areas of European life.
I freely acknowledge the faults of the civilizationalists, but I note that they're not unique, these faults, to the civilizationalists. They're shared by many. So let's stop focusing on the faults. Let's criticize them. Fair enough. But let's look at the larger picture and what they're advocating. And is this a good idea or a bad idea?
So, yeah, in order to achieve a critical mass in terms of bolstering how things were, Western civilization, the European inheritance, all of these things, does there have to be some international coordination between these parties? And how likely is that to develop?
I don't know that international coordination is that important. They're trying. Salvini goes to see Orban, and Wilders goes to see Le Pen and the like. But I don't know that it's so important. I think each country has its own specific situation, and in each country the voters are responding to those situations. Now, they're cooperating at the EU level in some fashion, but no, I think these are autonomous national evolutions that we're witnessing.
So if we were to focus our attention on the monastery just outside Rome, where Steve Bannon is deep in contemplation of these matters, and trying to form a united European movement of nationalist or civilizationalist parties, you don't see any serious prospect for that.
No, I don't. And the fact that he's been rejected by so many of the parties would point to the autonomous nature that they wish to focus on.
They were ahead as well, really, weren't they, when it comes to these issues, which have really surfaced in American mainstream politics only, I would say, with the election of Donald Trump. The Europeans have been talking in public in this way, as it were, for a good while longer. In fact, since the end of the Cold War, perhaps, the moment that Europe opened up again, was reunited, and the whole prospect of a formation of a single European state with freedoms of movement and so on, almost immediately these issues of national identity and expression started to gain traction with new parties and so on, and the Belgium, for example, and the Netherlands. But there isn't. I think there's a tendency always to think the United States is ahead, when in fact it seems to me to be a good 20-odd years behind this trend. What do you think?
Well, certainly when it comes to immigration, the United States is way behind. Also, the Islam issue, way behind. These are far more prominent, indeed even dominant, issues in Europe than the United States.
When we're talking about the place of Islam in public life in the United States versus Europe, it's often said that these are quite different situations have developed in the U.S. versus Europe. How would you define them?
Yes, indeed, there are many differences. To begin with, the United States has always been an immigration country. France has been as well, but it's the exception. Otherwise, most European countries tend to be what I call big families, which share culture, food, dances, language, religion, and into which Somalis and Kurds have a very hard time fitting. There's no context for them. So it's inherently far more difficult for Europeans to assimilate immigrants, especially ones from a different part of the world. Secondly, the United States has a very large convert population, black Americans, number something like 750,000, nothing comparable to that in Europe. Thirdly, whereas in Europe, immigrants, Muslim immigrants in particular, tend to be either very elite or quite low down on the socioeconomic pole. In the United States, Muslim immigrants are thought to have a socioeconomic status equal or even greater to that of the population at large. Very many doctors and engineers, for example. So it's a quite different situation.
So if for Madden, for the moment, you are the prime minister of a medium-sized European state. You have a population of recent Muslim immigrants who are showing signs of losing contact, in effect, with the mainstream of society, high rates of school dropout, law-breaking, and so on. What would be the way in which you would change this pattern or break it or try to integrate people if, as you say, the European state is a sort of monoculture where it's their way or no way at all? How can you broaden or not broaden and simply make people belong anyway? What a way out of this would you have?
I would devote considerable time and resources to finding ways and consultation with the Muslim community to bring it into the mainstream of society, including education, religion, language, and so forth. I would do everything I could to encourage reform Islam and reject the extreme version known as Islamism.
Would you say that the French government, when it banned, you know, the burqa and even the burkini, are these interventions too far, or are they the sort of thing that creates a space in which individual Muslims can assimilate and a reform Islam, like the reformed versions of Christianity and Judaism that developed in Europe, could develop?
Yeah, interesting question. I'm absolutely in favor of banning the burqa, not because it stifles the woman's creativity or anything like that, but because it is a security menace. I happen to have a blog with maybe 120 items and continuously expanding of burqas as accessories to crime and other forms of violence, terrorism, jihad. It is a danger. You have people walking around under a tent. You don't know if it's male or female, and you don't know if it's carrying a violin or a machine gun. Endless cases of problems coming from burqas and niqabs. So absolutely would ban those in public. Now, in private, you wear what you want in public. On the other hand, the burkini, which is a modest form of swimwear, I don't particularly find it attractive, but I can't see any justification whatsoever to ban it. You may wear to the beach whatever covering you like. It seems to me arrogant and implausible to try and ban this modest form of swimwear.
Isn't one of the problems that, say, in the French situation, that they're working from universal principles, and that means the burqa in law, or anyway, at least, cannot be banned as a specific item, because that would be a non-universal discriminatory ruling.
No. All you can't wear a tent.
All religious items in public spaces become therefore suspect. This is the issue that has risen, with the wearing of a crucifix or the wearing of a kippah or something, that everybody loses because of this specific issue. Is that the way to go, or is that going to make it more difficult in some ways?
No, you're absolutely right. There should be no religious nature to this, to any legislation. It should say that you can't walk around the streets under a tent. It's not a full face covering. It is a full body covering. It covers you from tip of your head to your feet, and no one knows who's under there. That is a security menace. We have actually legislation in the United States, anti-Ku Klux Klan, where they wore all body coverings, that prohibits it. Let's just apply that to burqas and niqabs.
Do you see the development of sectarian Islamist political parties in Europe? You know, at the time of the last French election, Michel Houellebecq's newest novel came out and was seen as prophetic, as it were. Do you see that as a realistic development?
I do. The Turks are busy. The Turkish government is busy fomenting such Muslim/Islamist parties, like Denk in the Netherlands. Their parties, for example, in Bulgaria, an important party. It is, as the Muslim population grows, it is likely that these Muslim parties will grow with the population, cultivated by the Turks and perhaps the Qataris and others.
These parties would, in their own way, be civilizationist parties, in a sense, wouldn't they? They would be traditional identitarian parties. Yep. Wouldn't their natural allies, therefore, be, in a sense, with other socially conservative parties, perhaps on the right, which makes it strange that they find themselves repeatedly in alliance with parties on the left. Why?
Well, I think that makes good sense. They can't cooperate with what I'm calling civilizationist parties because they want different civilizations. They can cooperate with the left because the left, broadly speaking, doesn't like Western civilization. So they find a natural alliance with the left. Left is premised on criticism of Western civilization.
And do you see the left as getting stronger or weaker? There's an enormous interest in the media and among young people as well with left-wing candidates. But, for instance, the Democratic Party didn't put up a left-wing presidential candidate in 2016. Doesn't look likely to do it now. And similar things can be seen in the tension between the grassroots and party management across Europe. But do you see the left as strengthening or?
Yes, I do. I think the left, the fundamental assumption of the left is more in keeping with modern times than the fundamental assumption of the right. By which I mean, the right's fundamental assumption is that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, that we must very respectfully look at our traditions and, of course, change them. That's what we have legislatures for. You change, you adapt, but you change cautiously. You do so slowly and with much consideration. The left doesn't have that respect for tradition and says, you, Dominic Green, you're a genius.
Well, that's very kind.
You figure it out
on
your own.
I may vote left
from here on. You figure it out on your own. You've no need for tradition. And if tradition says that marriage is between a man and a woman, you figure out for yourself whether you agree with that. If tradition says there are two genders, you figure it out. How many you think there are? 10, 20, 70? In other words, the liberal attitude is that each of us is so smart that we don't have to depend on tradition. We can think it through for ourselves. This has led to tremendous disaster as individuals think that they have the capability to do that and then promote those ideas. But they're not all bad ideas, but a lot of them are. But it's in keeping with the modern sensibility. Either you're really rich and you think you can think it all for yourself, or you're really poor and you're disgruntled about the current situation, you're well-educated, etc., you're an immigrant. All these cases you think you have, you're attracted to an attitude that says you are competent to rethink all this on your own. And so that's why I think the left is gaining, in a secular sense, over the right.
You describe the alliance of left and Islamist factions as a marriage of convenience, in a sense, that they both object to the same traditionalism or traditional hereditary values. At the same time, there's an enormous contrast, shall we say, between the sacred principles of hyper-liberal individualism that you describe and the principles of Islam as generally subscribed to or practiced.
Conservative, yes.
Which is, as we would say, socially conservative with a very big S and a very big C. At some point, presumably, there has to come a breaking point in that you have the majority of people in a state voting, say, for a left-wing party because, as you say, it will allow them to live as they choose. And yet that same party relies, in order to get over the electoral line, it relies upon the support, say, of large numbers of Muslims in the major cities, which is the sort of pattern we see in Europe. That, to me, does not sound like a long-term, you know, plan for a stable alliance between, left parties and Islamist groups.
It'll be stable so long as they have a tactical alliance against the right. Should they win and the right be destroyed, then they'll fall out among themselves. I mean, the Western allies had a stable alliance with Stalin so long as there was Hitler. Mm-hmm. Once that war was over, the alliance was gone.
Do you see signs of this breaking up already if you look at the popularity? I mean, one of the major groups of voters who are moving to the parties you call civilizationalists, and they're often very much parties which are either skeptical or reformist or openly hostile to the EU as well. A lot of their supporters are coming from the traditional parties of the left, which are failing to protect the welfare systems, in effect, that people have now take for granted. Do you see that as a sign already of a breakup in that left Islamist alliance?
There is the potential. I note that Jeremy Corbyn, Mélenchon in France, and the Aufsteigen movement in the Social Democratic Party in Germany are all breaking ranks with the pro-immigration forces. And they're doing so for sensible reasons. The workers are not eager to have a large number of inexpensive competition. And so these and other elements on the left are saying, whoa, be careful about how many people come into the country. So there is a potential there. But so far, that is a small part of the left. The left in general is interested in enthusiastic about immigration, in part because this means you dilute Western civilization.
And it's new voters in the meantime, even as older ones might start looking at their mortgages and tax bills and shifting towards centrist or even conservative parties. Looking at these trends, and you've identified trends across Europe, for instance, breaking up of traditional allegiances rather with political parties, the digression of Eastern European states from this path of open-ended immigration from Muslim countries, and as you say, the civilizationist position. Where do you see, say, the European Union being in 5 or 10 years' time on these issues? Because one of the immediate effects of the immigration crisis of 2015 was the reappearance of borders within Europe. And they're not going to come down. I mean, they haven't come down yet, and there's no sign to suggest that they ever will. We already seem to have passed the threshold there of being into it, something new. How do you think this is going to affect the development of the European Union and the possibility, of course, which France and Germany are still committed to, of pushing towards forming a single state, which includes, of course, the freedom of movement within it?
I think once Europe has taken control of its borders, which are basically Spain, Italy, and Greece, then the open border project within Europe can resume. But it doesn't have control. It is 70 kilometers from Tunisia to a small island in Italy, of Italy. It is 14 kilometers across the Straits of Gibraltar. It is a few hundred meters from Turkey to Greece. There's a river separating them. It's 10 meters from Morocco to Spain. In
Ceuta and Melilla.
Right, Ceuta and Melilla. And then there's the Mediterranean as a whole and the boats going into it. So this is the first problem that the EU has. I think it's easily fixed. If you want to control your borders, you can. So far, the will hasn't been there. But I think it's emerging, and when that happens, then it'll be easier to revert back to the open borders within the Schengen area.
And how do you see relations with Turkey developing? The issue was raised again in the middle of May, whether Turkey should simply abandon any prospect of ever entering the European Union. It may well be that Erdogan has already assumed that Turkey will not be entering the European Union, at least not politically. But how do you think this is going to affect Europe's position regarding the immigration of Muslims?
Well, two different questions. Let's start with Turkey and its prospects for accession. Well, I always found it implausible that Turkey should be part of the EU. Imagine that Gibraltar were not in off of Spain, but off of Morocco. Would that make Great Britain an African state, member of the African Union? It's a little exaggerated, but you get my point. Turkey is part of the Middle East. It's part of the Muslim world. It's quite different. And Europeans, whenever they had a chance to express themselves on this issue, have said no, they don't want Turkey. I don't think that Erdogan particularly wanted to join the EU. He was using EU accession as a means of controlling the military. He changed the constitution in accordance with EU principles to get more control and ultimately total control over the military. I think it was tactical. And once that was done, he lost interest. As for immigration of Muslims, your second point, I think immigration of Muslims and more broadly of Africans, Muslim or not, is going to be a pressure on Europe that will grow going to come into the EU. I see more like 400 or 500 million, or the same number of people who actually live in the EU now. Africa, the demographers say, is going to go up from 1.2 billion now to 2 billion in 2050 and 4 billion in 2100. If that's accurate, the 750 million, including Russia, who live in Europe, are a rather small number.
No, I mean, also, isn't this, there is a revolution of rising expectations taking place, which is as people become more educated and more affluent, they become more ambitious and of course, they're able to travel more and so on. Mm-hmm. I believe that Albania is the place to look to in the terms of that once a state achieves the level of development and GDP and economic opportunity in Albania, which is not the most successful of European states, then there's actually incentives for them to stay at home rather than to chance it by making a dangerous and expensive journey elsewhere. Right. The European states don't really yet, certainly not the European Union either, seem to have any plan for how to, help the states of North Africa, let alone sub-Saharan Africa, reach the Albanian level.
It's rather difficult. The United States began the project of foreign aid after World War II. I think it's safe to say it has had no success. What works are either emergency aid packages of blankets and soup, save people's lives, or bribes to get the government to be friendly to you. But development aid as such has a very, very undistinguished record. I don't think there's any country you can point to that developed because of foreign aid. It has to be internal. It has to do with one's own culture, one's own practices, one's own economic ideas. So while Europe is spending money in Africa, I don't think that's really the key. It's up to the Africans to develop their own economies and their own opportunities, their own jobs. And to some extent, that's happening. It's not quite as bad as it was 10 years ago, but it has a long way to go.
And my last question is, if you were to look into your crystal ball and prognosticate, how far ahead do you think it'll be before a civilizationist party becomes a major player, rather than, say, a coalition partner, in a major Western European state? Do you see that happening, or do you see a real breach occurring between the Western European and Eastern European futures?
I think the Austrian model of a civilizationalist party partnering with a traditional conservative party is likely to be replicated elsewhere, in particular in Germany and France, also in the Netherlands and Sweden, Spain, elsewhere. I think it's going to be happening all over. Less frequent will be what you see in Italy, which is a civilizationalist party with a, I don't know what to call the five-star leftist anarchist party. That's less likely. It will happen perhaps here and there. And least likely of all is what you see in Hungary, which is the civilizationalist party running the show all by itself. But combination with the conservative party looks like a very productive alliance in the future of Europe.
Daniel Fipes, thank you very much. And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with him, Daniel Pipes, in the Green Room, Spectator USA's weekly Life and Arts podcast. Join us next week in the Green Room for more Life and Arts, and in the meantime, you can find us and satisfy all your podcast needs by looking for us on iTunes under Spectator USA. Until then, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.